Blog Talk Radio.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
Okay, welcome back. Hello, Peter. Are you there?
Hi, Bill. I'm right here.
Excellent. And so, hey, are you right now in that $8 billion building? Are you in that building right now?
You know, I wish I were. You know, I think you're talking about our new football stadium, and they've just done an incredible job there. We're actually doing a little facility upgrade ourselves too. Currently we have a co-ed locker room, which is probably one of the few in college tennis, and we're going to upgrade that to have separate locker room facilities for our kids and some showers here. So it's that's our big facility upgrade going on.
I'm thinking that's either a recruiting tool or it's not.
We can't decide ourselves. I think when we bring our donors in and they have to use the restroom and it's co-ed, they kind of say, I think it might be time for you to take a step forward, into the 21st century. So we're that's what we're going to do.
I'm going to hold it. So tell us a little bit about your growing up in Berkeley and how you got involved with tennis.
Well, my parents immigrated from Northern Ireland in the late 50s, and I was born here in Berkeley, and I was a public parks player, so I really wasn't a member of the Berkeley Tennis Club, which was quite prestigious at the time, in the Claremont Hotel. I just grew up playing on the public parks, and neither of my parents, my dad played a little bit of tennis. There was a little bit of that in our house, but not much, but I just sort of found tennis, and tennis found me. Developed a lot of friends around the public parks and just kind of continued to grow through the years and went through the Berkeley Public Schools. In junior high school, I was one of the better players. And then when I got to high school, I was, as a freshman, I was one of the better freshmen that Berkeley High had in quite a while, although Berkeley High has quite a tennis legacy.
Sure.
And worked my way through there and ended up going to school at Cal. So I really I'm Berkeley through and through.
Let's get back to Ireland for a second. Which town did your parents come from there?
You know, my dad is from Ballycastle on the very, very northern tip of Ireland, and my mom is from Omagh. So, you know, growing up, my mom, when we were living here in California in Berkeley, she worked for United Airlines. And my dad was a teacher here in the Berkeley school. So I had every summer off, and we would fly back to Ireland. So I spent a lot of my youth growing up in Northern Ireland. And that was also exciting because there's not a lot of tennis there, a lot of bad weather. But in the summertime, the tennis comes out, and there's some grass courts up in Ballycastle. So I got to go back and play tournaments you know, all through my youth.
But you haven't really picked up much of an accent there, Peter. So,
No, I didn't pick up the accent, but you know, when I finished college and you know, started to play a little more, I picked up a wife over there. So my wife is actually from Dublin, and we've been married 21 years now. So I did drag her back to California with me, but no, we've got great Irish family and heritage.
Well, I was chatting with Alistair McCaw, and we were talking about the Ireland connection, and he had mentioned you, and then and that you were also from there. And then I was sharing with him that my family was known as the Ulster Scots because they'd been sent from northern Scotland to Ireland, and then were encouraged to leave and go to the New World in the late 1500s. Anyway, enough about that. Get back to tennis. When would you say you really received your best coaching and development of your game, and what was kind of that pivotal moment where you knew you could compete at the collegiate level?
Well, you know, when I was in high school, I was pretty good, and I went to see a guy who was a former number one player at Cal, and he was out at the Moraga Country Club, and a guy named Doug King. And Doug was a great player. He was one of the, you know, he played number one at Cal, and he had been taught by Tom Stowe, who's a legendary coach in Northern California. So Doug, I worked with Doug for quite a while, and it was very interesting because it was some coaching and teaching that was something that wasn't out there for a lot of people, and it was very much, you know, in the Stowe methodology, but it was Doug's own take on it, which for me actually worked quite well. So Doug was one of the people who really helped me grow as a person and as a tennis player in those high school years, and gave me the thoughts about, you know, playing in college and playing on the pro tour, and gave me the confidence to really reach for those goals.
And how did he do that?
Well, you know, I played baseball as a kid, so I had a pretty good arm, and so, you know, my serve was decent. Doug taught me how to hit a backhand, but I think more than anything, he really slowed the game down for me. As a teenager, you're kind of bopping around, your attention is here, there, everywhere, but he taught me things that are so important, like breathing, you know, contact with the ground, things that you don't really, you know, when you're teaching, people are talking about your grip and your follow-through. That wasn't where we spent a lot of our time. We spent time on almost the mind more than anything else, slowing things down, getting a feel for tennis. Doug's up at Meadowood right now. He's been the pro there for 30 years since, and he's an innovator. I don't know if you've ever had him on the show, but he'd be a great guy. Just so insightful and bright. He's a brilliant mind. But no, in terms of the confidence, I think we didn't really even talk about that. It was more a sense of, you know, this is how the game should be played. This is how you should play the game, and I embraced that, and I took my time learning almost the zen of tennis with Doug, and that just allowed me to, you know, I had a burning desire. I was a very competitive person. And so I sort of combined the zen with the absolute competitive nature I brought to the equation, and slowly got better and better at it, and realized that I could beat some of the guys that I've been looking up to for many, many years just through hard work and being intelligent about how I approached my practices and how I played the game.
I like how you said combining the zen with the competitive, because not too many people are familiar with the idea that, Tim Galloway wrote a second book, because his first book was The Inner Game of Tennis, and his second book was Inner Tennis Playing the Game, which is much more practical in my mind. So I actually think that's one of my top five books I've ever read. Well, anyway, he goes through all, he fleshes out all the exercises to sort of, you know, get your whole Zen thing going. And the last chapter is about the will to win. Because once you've kind of got cleared away all the clutter, then you actually become much more focused on the object at hand. So I think that that's something for me to think about and want to share that. So I appreciate your comment. Now, let's shift to the Irish Davis Cup team. So as a member of that team, is there anything to share there?
Well, you know, when I finished playing at Cal, I was a pretty good college player, but not a great college player, and I was ready to go out and try my wares on the pro tour. But I went back to Ireland because I hadn't been there in a little while, that much through high school. And, you know, one of my buddies said, "Hey, have you ever thought about playing Davis Cup for Ireland? Because you're not good enough to play for the U.S." And I said, "Well, you know, I actually hadn't." And I went to the Irish Federation. I said, "Well, are you interested in the possibility of me playing Davis Cup for Ireland?" And they said, "Well, yeah, sure we are. Are you eligible?" And I said, "Absolutely." And then I got an Irish passport, and so I played a couple of local tournaments in Ireland, and they said, "No, we want you to play." And it was the start of a 7-year playing Davis Cup for Ireland. And then after that, I was the Davis Cup captain for 7 years and took a team to the Olympics in Atlanta. So, you know, playing Davis Cup for Ireland was fantastic because that suited my personality quite well. I didn't like being on the outside courts or on the back courts. Center court was, you know, where I wanted to play. And sure, we had to play some tough matches down in Africa and you know, through Europe. But the experience was extraordinary, and it's a continuation of college tennis. You're part of a team, and you have a goal. And you know, this is now, you know, it's your country versus the other country. And so the experiences were incredible, and really from the geography of most of our matches were concentrated in that Euro-African zone. So we played in Nairobi, we played in Senegal and Portugal, and it was just an incredible experience.
Yeah, I mean, that's irreplaceable, that stuff. And I think sometimes people lose sight of the dream of being a pro tennis player because of the lifestyle. I think people get so focused on a number, on a ranking and whatnot. I'm sure you must be familiar with Hunter Galloway here.
Sure.
Hunter was telling a story about being 450 in the world, but playing in China, and the bus tour was going to go see the Great Wall, so he hopped on it with one other player. All the other players stayed in their room playing video games. So get on the bus, people. Get out there, be like Peter, and go around the world playing tennis, and you'll never forget it.
That reminds me of just one story we had in Davis Cup where we actually were in Nairobi, and we were in such a low division that we had to play four matches in 5 days, and we had one day off in the middle. And I said, "Boys, we're going to go on a safari." And they said, "Are you crazy? We got to play four matches." "No, we're going to go on a one-day safari here in Nairobi." And I said, "What are you going to do, stay in your room and watch TV all day?" And they said, "Yeah." And I said, "No, we're going on a safari." So, you know, long story short, we went out and just had an unbelievable experience. And the guys were, you know, just, they said, "It's like the Nature Channel." It was everything all wrapped into one. And I said, "The next time you come here, it'll be, you know, 20 years from now and with your family, and it'll cost you $1 million. We're doing it for free right now." And we went on to win the Davis Cup matches as well. So it was a win-win all the way around.
Flesh out kind of what's the philosophy behind what these people learned from Tom.
Well, you know, that's a good question. I'm probably not the right guy to ask that because I got it secondhand from Doug. I got it filtered down one generation. So I think one of the fundamental things I got from it was the piece of my game that I got that was outstanding was A, my balance, and B, my backhand, which was you know, there was only one time. I love my backhand, and it was just a great shot. And you know, one year we're playing Wimbledon, and it rains like crazy, and we're on the practice courts, and we had to actually share the practice courts because there had been so much rain, and we had these two old guys from the seniors come out. And so they had half the court, and we had half the court. And I didn't really pay much attention because we only had about 30 minutes on the grass. And these guys, old guys, start hitting next to us, and I'm hitting with my partner. And I look over, and the guy next to me, and I watch him hit a backhand. I said, whoa, that's a nice backhand. Whoa, that's a really nice backhand. And so I took a little, you know, I watched a couple more. I said, wait a second, that's Ken Rosewall. So I got a chance to one of the amazing shots in the game. But now, you know, a little a little snippet out of it. But no, from Tom Stowe, you know, he's such a legend here in the Berkeley area and at Cal. I mean, part of our facility is Stowe Plaza. So that just lets you know how important he is and what his legacy is like here at Cal.
Well, one person, and I forget where this came from, it might have been Joel Drucker, said that Tom Stowe would even say that he learned everything that he knows about tennis from coaching Don Budge and learning from observing Don Budge. So it could be that you have some Don Budge in your backhand there. Let's just go with it. Just pretend like that's true, and then we can move on to the next thing. So let's go into a commercial, and when we come back, let's talk about other coaching influences and what are some of the cornerstones of your philosophy. So we're going to go to this message, and then we'll be right back.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike tennis camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike tennis camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike tennis camps and take your game to the next level.
Okay, we're back. So, Peter, who are some of the other people who've been influential in helping you develop your coaching philosophy?
Well, you know, one of them comes to mind, you know, is my coach here at Cal, Bill Wright, who was such an energetic and enthusiastic human being. And so his love of life just rubbed off on everybody who was around him. And it's, you know, it's not easy coaching in college. You've got a lot of different personalities on the team. But Bill really did a great job of injecting his enthusiasm into everything he did. And I think that's something that I learned a lot from, because just that positive, upbeat attitude, the love of life, is contagious, and it makes the people around you better. And you know, Bill was a competitor. He really, you know, taught us a lot about how to fight through some tough spots and tough matches. And again, with that positive attitude of looking at the bright side of it. Another coach who was important to me, you know, we talk about a lot of this coach's successes, but they never talk about his failures. Jose Higueras. You know, Jose coached me for a short period of time while I was on the tour, and I tease him all the time. I say, Jose, everybody talks about, you know, Chang and Courier and Federer, but they never mention my name when they talk about people you've coached. Jose also, you know, very, you know, what a wonderful, again, wonderful human being, incredibly knowledgeable about the sport. And as a teacher, you know, he combines that sort of that disciplinarian with a good sense of humor in there as well. And you know when Jose is serious, and you know when Jose is you know, relaxing a little bit. But I liked and learned a lot from him in terms of working with people. You know, he's just done an incredible job with a lot of players. But one of the things about Jose that is really interesting is Jose's a listener, and that's so important as a coach to be able to listen and hear what your students and what your athletes are saying to you as opposed to just pontificating and throwing out all the things that you know or that you think you know and trying to get that information out. So Jose was a master at that, and I think I learned a lot from him in that area.
So I was looking you up on Wikipedia, and so can you talk a little bit about your affiliation with MI5?
Wrong Peter Wright. You know, I do have a few passports.
Yeah, I thought it was curious that it said you passed away in 1996. So, okay, we'll move past that pretty quickly. But everybody, go do a wiki search on Peter Wright, and you'll know what I'm talking about. All right, let's go on to recruiting. What does a Cal tennis player look like?
Well, you know, it's interesting. We have a fairly balanced mix of California guys and foreign players, and that goes a little bit to Berkeley's reputation around the world as an academic institution. The profile of our player, we like them big, and we like them to be able to come into the net and finish at the net. So when we're looking at guys, we're looking for guys who really have a skill set and a desire. Really, it goes back to the desire, the competitiveness in each one of them. So we don't want the guy who's and we've had over the years. I've been here 21 years, and every so often, back in the early days, I would make a decision and thought I had the right guy coming in, but he was more at the end of his playing career, and he was, you know, that he had enough, or he'd been pushed by his parents all the time, and so when he got to college, it was time to just kind of relax and get away from that. So, you know, we try to do a lot of work on the front end to make sure that the guy we bring in is someone who wants to play after college, and that's important for us. So right now we have 6 players on our team who have ATP points. So that just gives you an idea of the level that you need to be at to be here, and also where we want to go and where we want to take guys with their game. So the profile of our guys, they're tough players, they're tough competitors, but they're out there every day working hard, looking at a degree from Berkeley, but also looking at the Pro Tour after being here.
Yeah, that's great. And so what's the myth that you can dispel?
Well, you know, it's not a myth, but it's something that used to be. When I went to school here, the athletes did not get any kind of preferential treatment. You had to fight to get into your classes. You had to fight against everybody else to get your schedule right. There were a lot of challenges there, even from an academic support standpoint. There was really not a lot of support there. But over the years, the university has changed, and now you know, our kids get preferential treatment. They get to select their classes ahead of the other students because the universities recognize that they have needs. They can't have class during practice, so they get those classes. They also, we have an academic study center that has been studied by a lot of other colleges around the country to see how much they do for our student athletes. So the university's made a full commitment to our student athlete population, which is wonderful, but it wasn't there when I was here. So a lot of people say, oh my gosh, if you go to Cal, it's going to be, you know, academically, it's going to be really tough. You're going to be on your own. It's a big school and they won't do anything for you. And now that would have been true 25 years ago. But now that's not the case. And so the guys really do get well taken care of. And I think what's happened is our school, it's kind of a staggering statistic if you think about it, but our student-athlete population, if Cal were a country at the last Olympics, we would have finished 16th in the medal count. And that's the last two Olympics, actually. 17th one year and 16th the other in the overall medal count. So our chancellor came in from Canada and he says, you know, our university here at Berkeley has won more medals than all of Canada. So it's a big deal. So we try to run it like a Olympic training facility. That really is, and it really, for all intents and purposes, is an Olympic training facility. And that's how our athletes are treated.
Thank you for that. So here's a question from Pez, and it always makes me think Pez Dispenser when I see his name. he's a really big Cal fan, and he wants to know, what's it going to take for Cal to be really in the running for a national championship? So what's going to happen for you to pass the quarterfinals?
Well, it's a good question. I think it's the one that keeps me up at night. But really what has to happen, you know, the last couple of years, actually the last 3 years, we've lost in the round of 16. Last 2 years, we've lost to Virginia. Virginia's had a pretty good team the last couple of years. They got to the finals 2 years ago, and then they won it last year. So they're pretty rough. But for us, it's about our top guys, you know, keeping them healthy. Last year, we had six guys who were very, very good. One of them went down in the third match. Our team captain went down in the third match of the year, and we went. Our record at number six singles was, I think, 3-28. So that didn't help us out a lot last year. But this year, coming in, our recruiting class is incredible. It actually is one of the best recruiting classes we've ever had. As I said, this year we now have six players with ATP points, and then we've got some commitments for next year already that could give us another outstanding careers or outstanding class. So, yeah, you got to be in the hunt. We've got to get past the quarterfinals. I think we've got now the personnel to do it this year, and you've got to be good for a few years in order to win an NCAA championship, and you got to maybe get a little lucky at the end. But if you're one of those top five teams, then you've got an opportunity to do that, and I think that's what we're positioning ourselves to do this year and in the coming couple of years.
Well, Peter, I think you and your staff are going to coach powerfully and fearlessly, and then it's going to happen. I'm rooting for you guys big time. I'll just get that right out there. Okay, so now let's shift gears, and we'll go into kind of what is some advice for players and parents and coaches as they're trying to prepare someone to be a pro and then maybe take a stop and play college tennis on the way to a pro career. What advice would you give to a player as they're developing and wanting to play college?
Well, I think there's a couple things. You know, one of the things that's happened over the years is some guys have pulled out of school entirely to pursue a pro career, and that's been you know, it's worked for a couple of guys, but it doesn't really work in the grand scheme, and it hasn't worked well for a number of them. The second thing is homeschooling is a challenge, and I think you know, in general, homeschooling is a great concept, but in reality, it sometimes doesn't produce the results and outcome that you want in terms of growth, emotionally and academically. I've seen a couple of programs where you can do a little bit of both, so some traditional high school and some homeschool, which actually works a lot better. But in terms of the players themselves, I mean, that's been part of my conversations with USTA and USTA player development is, you know, what role does college play for a lot of these young people coming through? And now the statistics are quite staggering about the lack of teenagers in the top 100. You know, what does an 18-year-old do if he's ranked 500? Does he go pro and play futures and challengers, or does he go to college for a year or two or three before he's ready for the pro tour? And now you're seeing quite clearly that the top American juniors are going to college for a couple of years. You know, Mackie McDonald, who's a local guy here in Piedmont, headed off to UCLA this year, unfortunately for us, but, you know, good for Mackie. And you know, we've been part of that whole conversation. I've been part of that conversation with the USTA for a number of years. And one of the things that we came up with for the young guys was an event that we do up in Napa that brings the best U.S. juniors to play against the best college players so that the juniors have feedback. And we had Jack Sock come up and play after he'd won the Junior U.S. Open and play against the best college guys. And that's been a big deal, and I think that, you know, when you talk to parents about you know, what they can do for their kids is to give them more opportunities to play against their next peer group, which is the college players. And the USTA has embraced this idea of trying to get more opportunities for the juniors to play against the college players, doing it at several sites around the country now. Florida State is doing one in Orlando. There's one up in Portland as well. And so that's really key. Because, you know, you can get seduced by being out on the tour and have some success in the futures and maybe even a little in the challengers, but it's not enough to sustain a career. And college really is a stepping stone for, you know, 99.9% of the guys coming through because, you know, as I say, if you're a teenager, you're not going to be in the top 100. And so you need to be somewhere developing during that time when you're getting ready for the pro tour.
Yeah, and can you go a little deeper into this NAPA event? Like, when is it, and how would people find out about it? And is there a way to kind of get into the circuit? I don't know if there's a circuit of these different things, but so how about a little more info on the NAPA event?
Well, here's, you know, this is what we did. We had a turn of an all-collegiate event up there, and then I approached the USTA and player development and said, why not bring the best juniors? Why don't you bring the 8 best juniors, and we'll put them with 24 of the best college players, and we'll let them have at it in a little round robin over the course of a weekend. We do it in September. We do it 2 weeks after the U.S. Open, so we just had it a couple of weeks ago. And it was such a success. What happens is the juniors play against the college guys, and the winner of the event, overall event, gets a wild card into a USTA Pro Circuit event, whether it's a Futures or a Challenger. And so there's a lot of incentive for everybody there, the college guys and the juniors, to win this event. And after doing it, they said, wow, we really like this. This is a great concept, great idea. Let's do it in as many places as we can. It's a little complicated to put together, and there were a lot of NCAA rules that we had to work with. But the national governing body has a lot of leeway in terms of the NCAA rules. And so, you know, they want to see, and we actually this year we had the president, USTA President Dave Hegarty, there at the event, and he was in attendance, and we talked about it, and he said, you know what, I like this. I'd like to see us doing more of these in the United States, and so that's encouraging. He really has a great vision as a president, and these events, you know, we do it because we want American juniors to get better. So it's a win-win all the way around. And I think you'll see maybe not a proliferation, but I think you'll see a gradual increase in these events around the country as people embrace the format and embrace really what's going on, bringing the best juniors in to play against the best college guys.
Well, I think another benefit, too, there is what a great testing ground for them to be able to make a realistic decision about whether they might be ready to start a pro career. Because you better come in and pretty much take care of everybody at that event if you think you're going to go pro. Okay, so college tennis, there's some decisions being made recently. I got the email from Wayne Bryan discussing the possibility or the reality of changes to how the college tennis will be played, but I don't have all the information. So can you kind of get into what are the facts of what's being proposed or what's coming into play?
Well, you know, college tennis has been in a little bit of a state of flux the last couple of years. The NCAA committee made a decision two years ago to try and change the structure of a match to have a 10-point tiebreaker played for the third set of singles. And that was met with a lot of opposition from the USTA and the ITA, the Intercollegiate Tennis Association. So that was reversed a little bit. And then this summer, the USTA came up with a great concept, or they came up with it actually earlier, of college match day, which is very similar to college game day for football and basketball. It's an exciting way of promoting the events. And And that was it's a great idea, a wonderful concept. And but one of the they also felt that maybe the format of a college match was something that they wanted to look at doing something different with. And so one of the format they chose was one that really didn't have doubles as part of it. It was just basically to bring a dual match down to singles only, singles first, and only playing doubles if it was tied 3-all. And if it was tied 3-all, they would just play 3 10-point tiebreakers of doubles. So basically doubles was eliminated from a college match, if you will. And they felt that this would be an exciting format and something to experiment with. But that was also met with quite a bit of I was actually one of the people who wasn't too pleased about that. And I said, wow, I'm really I think doubles really is what partly what embodies college tennis, and it's part of the teamwork and team effort that goes into it. And also from the fan standpoint, it's incredibly exciting. But in the backdrop, there's television. There are a lot of different interests and a lot of stakeholders in tennis, from the new regional networks or conference networks, the Pac-12 network, the Big 12 network. They all want to televise, and they are televising tennis, which is good. But they're also looking for a format that's exciting. And some people feel that a shorter college match is a better direction for people to go, that a lot of people can't sit through a whole match. And they may be right. But we're looking at that, at what's going to be a more compelling format, what can shorten a match possibly down to a 2.5 to 3-hour window, which will help television, which will help our fan base, help us bring new fans to the game. But there are a lot of ideas out there, but I think what's happened is a lot of the stakeholders need to get together, and there sort of needs to be a super committee, if you will, of USTA, NCAA, ITA, television folks to get together and say, okay, you know, how do we want to shape college tennis going forward, and how do we make it a compelling entertainment piece, but also development piece for the players who play and not taking away from the experience of the student athletes who come to play tennis. So it's a really complicated question, but I think there's some good answers out there, and we're going to work our way towards finding them.
You know, one thing I would encourage everyone to do is to hold special the special difficulty of being a champion tennis player, because ultimately, if you're going to be the best tennis player in the world, you have to be able to win 5-set matches in 100-degree weather with millions of people watching. That's the ultimately, because it's going to come down to that now and then, you know. And then the game itself is it's a great sport, and I challenge people with, hey, are you good enough to play this sport? And that feeds people's desire to want to be good enough to play the sport. But the thing that's disturbing to me is that people are trying to dumb down the sport to make it more accessible to people who might not really be that committed anyway. So I think I go the other way. And I want everyone to say, yes, absolutely, I believe in the 2 out of 3 sets match, and I think that the 10-point tiebreaker for a third set is an abomination, and it completely destroys the value of winning 2 full sets, and it hinders a good player's development in the ability to manage the momentum shifts that occur at the end of a set. So the more we have these 2-set and a tiebreaker matches, the more we're crippling the future development of our players. So there's my editorial is done. Any comments?
No, I think that's definitely right there in front and center in everybody's face. And, you know, the challenge is that's kind of how some of these committees have approached it. If that's the holy grail and you want a match that fits within a 2.5 to 3-hour window, then you're not playing doubles. So if you think doubles needs to be a part of the equation and that time constraint is you know, what you're, that's the goal you're trying to achieve, and I'm not so sure it is, by the way, but I'm just saying that if that's where people are saying, hey, we need this to be between 2.5 to 3 hours, then there's some changes. There's some sacrifices that have to be made. And, you know, I played when there was no ad scoring, and it was interesting. It was challenging, and you definitely couldn't lose your focus. And some people said it was an abomination. And, you know, looking back, I think it helped my development because it helped me hone my skills and narrow my focus because, you know, being up 40-15 on my serve, you know, you're 2 points from a break, you know, 2 points from being down break point. And that's a little different with regular scoring. So there are a lot of different things at work here. And it's interesting also because the college tennis season has a fall right now that we're in the fall and we play mostly just tournaments. So we're playing individual tournaments, singles and doubles. And then in the spring we play these team matches. And so we've got 4 months of team matches. Are people open to a different format for team matches that might be more exciting, might be a little bit shorter? And what does that do to player development? I mean, are we bastardizing our sport by playing short sets, for example, or by playing no ad? And those are tough questions. And those are questions that, you know, player development should have something to say about at the USTA. The USTA Marketing and Promotions Department should have something to say. The NCAA, who runs the NCAA championships, should say something. And the TV executives are there as well. I think what I'm being told is that the days of us being development, player development, are kind of gone, and it's more a sense of you are entertainment. You know, college tennis is entertainment, and so that's an interesting thing to have to think about. And if you're entertainment, then you can try to get as much player development out of that as possible. But in this era of we're televising everything, we're putting everything on the net, it's just an interesting place to be. Larry Scott, who's our commissioner of the Pac-12, said to me, he said, Pete, change is in the air. And if that's the case, then I think we should be out in front of it. And that was interesting. So I, you know, it's not as simple as we can say. I've been told by numerous people quite powerful in the sport that if you think you can stand in the same spot you're in right now, that isn't going to happen.
That's interesting because to me, entertainment is serving at 5-6 in the third set tiebreaker after having already played 3 hours and 30 minutes and your feet are burning and some sweaty sunscreen just went in your eye and you have to hit a second serve.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You know, and I mean, you know, entertainment is Pete Sampras throwing up on the court, hitting an 85-mile-an-hour first serve and you think he's done. And then he uncorks a 100-mile-an-hour second serve and stays alive. I don't know. It's, you know, I think we're going the wrong direction. I think the real true drama is when it's more difficult and it commands people's attention rather than becoming Mystery Science Theater 3000, short attention span theater. Yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying and that there are a lot of very large organizations that are at play and stakeholders and all of that. But I'm always going to be on the side of keeping it special. Because I really do believe we've got the greatest sport in the world. So, you know, we can attract people just as it is. I've always been successful in that. So
That's very true.
Okay, so now we're getting towards the end here. We've got maybe about 10 minutes, and then I have to do some of my little wrap up stuff that I do. But the next thing was in regard to the connections between Bay Area people and the Irish Davis Cup team and all that. Can you speak to kind of the interconnectedness of all of that?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of Irish in the area going back to Matt Doyle and the Farron family was very, very active in the Irish Davis Cup as well. And so it's you know, everybody wants to be Irish. I think, isn't that the way it is, Bill? The Irish have more fun.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Thing then, because we were talking about advice to players. Now let's speak to parents. All right, so you've got a parent, and you know they can be anywhere from, you know, the Theory Z parent that sees the sport as a lifelong, you know, educational opportunity to become a better person. And then you have the other parent who is going to drive their kid to succeed for the honor of the family. So speak to that range of parent and how are they going to encourage their youngster to prepare for college tennis?
Well, you know, it's a great question because every kid is different. Every parent is a little different. And I've heard kids say, my parents pushed me so much, I just hated it. And I want to get away from it as fast as I can. And then other kids say, my parents pushed me so much, and boy, am I glad they did, because it's given me the opportunity I have right now. So, you know, in terms of that, I don't have the answer. I don't know the answer there, but I do know that, you know, a lot of the studies show that the intrinsic motivation, if the kid likes to do what he's doing or she's doing, then that's the most important thing. And I that's one of the first questions I talk to guys about. You know, why do you like doing this? What about this is, you know, do you enjoy? And they get interesting answers from them. But at the end of the day, you got to love what you're doing. And, you know, just as a tennis coach, I know when I do practice, you can make practice not fun. You can make people not like tennis by, you know, forcing them to do certain things and just beating the joy in life out of it. So we all have to work towards keeping it interesting, keeping it lively, and keeping it fresh so you have their attention. And it's the same thing for kids. So when they have a good coach, when they have good people around them and they're stimulated, that's the best possible thing you can have. I would say that you want to make sure that, yeah, and I say this to a lot of parents, you want to have as many doors open to you as possible. At the end of the day, you want to be eligible for the best education you can get at the best tennis program you can find. And again, the big piece of the puzzle is kids should spend time with the coach on their recruiting visits or getting to know the coach at summer camps. But also when they get close to that, which school are they going to, they should spend time with the players on the team because those are the guys they're going to be spending a lot of time with, you know, day in, day out. Those are going to be their friends for life. And you know, is this the group of guys that they fit in with well? Or they share the same values? Are they an interesting group, or, you know, do they really like what they're doing? So my advice is always to ask a lot of questions and to be out there and be around your next peer group, see what they're doing, and learn from them, learn from their mistakes, learn from the things they do well, and then apply that to your own situation and see what makes the most sense.
Yeah, that's okay, great. So, you know, another question alongside of that is I interact with some people on Facebook and we have some great discussions about tennis and player development. One of the things that's come up in some of those discussions is that it's actually possible to find commonly that some college programs maybe don't have a lot of real work on their game, that it's actually fairly easy to find a school where you can skate. So how does someone find out whether they're going to a college program where everyone's held accountable, or that maybe it's one of those other ones where it's all up to the kid that provide his own motivation?
Well, yeah, I think that's the more time you spend around those programs, the more time you talk with people who have either gone through the program or are currently in the program, you start to get those feelings. And I think, you know, I'll go back to the USTA a little bit. One of the areas where we discussed could help college tennis the most and college tennis programs the most was with strength and conditioning coaches. because the strength and conditioning coaches typically at a lot of schools are the football strength and conditioning guy who's got, you know, okay, you got the tennis team now for a couple of hours. What are you going to do with them? Oh, let's bench, you know. So getting that more sophisticated for colleges. And so the USTA says, you know, that is important for us. Fitness is hugely important, and the specialized training that the tennis athletes need. So they created a program where I could send my strength and conditioning coach to get educated by them in the cutting-edge practices that they're using with the top athletes, so the John Isners of the world and Marty Fish and all the guys who are training for those five-set matches, and understand what those techniques are and what the periodization looks like for a tennis player, and then bringing that back to our team. So, again, that's happening more and more across the country to many programs. And so when you look at the ones who are committed and have a connection to getting their athletes better and smarter, it doesn't take too much. You need the coach who's engaged, and then an athletic department who supports the mission. Those two things are really important. But, you know, again, if you're looking for feedback, it's best to talk to the athletes who are there to get a good sample of them to say, yeah, how hard do you guys work? And, you know, do you really feel like you're getting better? And you know, what are the areas that, you know, what don't you like about this program? What do you like about the program? Because the coaches will tell you all that the world's a rosy place and you know, everything's wonderful. But the guys who are out there doing it day in, day out, they'll be able to provide you feedback that's valuable in helping you make a decision about where you want to go.
Well, and you'll also be able to tell if they're afraid to answer.
Absolutely, yeah.
If the eyes go left and right really quick, then look out. All right, so now if you had to sum up this this whole conversation, and you wanted to make sure that people took away one or two really main points of what we talked about, how would you sum this up?
Well, you know, I approach my job in an interesting way. I look at junior development and how it feeds into college and how it feeds into the pro tour. So my feelings are always about how people transition from one area to the next and how to help facilitate that. And one of our problems I felt was that, you know, college tennis wasn't engaged enough with junior tennis to help the juniors get better and make American juniors better. And so we came up with a way to do that on the college campuses around the country, and we developed that at Berkeley first, actually, and that's now at about 150 campuses around the country where the juniors, you know, 15, 16, 17-year-olds can come onto the campus and play against the college players. And then we developed our Napa event where we bring the juniors to play against the best college guys. So, you know, for me, that's how I like to look at what we do. We're about development. We're about the college pathway. We're about how players get through and all the way through to the pro tour, but also, you know, in terms of educating them and having a complete and whole person on the other end, where some of their careers might end in college and they might not be good enough to play in the pro tour. But are they getting that experience? Are they getting an education? Are they becoming better people? Because that's, to me, that's a big, important piece of what we do here.
That's great. And so, yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're really building bridges there. So, Peter, thank you so much for your time. It was great. I really appreciate all of your thoughtful answers. Hopefully I'll meet you in person live sometime.
You got it, Bill. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
All right. Take care. Okay. So, everybody, that was great. Peter had a lot of great insights, and a lot of that stuff was very new and surprising to me to hear about some of the upcoming changes. So I hope everybody's going to take this, and if you have a little sphere of influence there to influence this stuff and you've got a strong opinion, voice your opinion, stand up, be powerful, and fearless. Okay, so that was a pre-recorded show with Peter Wright, and we're live again right now. You can contact Peter Wright at pwright@berkeley.edu. P UPWRIGHT at berkeley.edu. Yeah, I'm hoping that when you contact him that it would be pretty much in relation to things that you've heard on the show. That would be great. You can also contact me at infinitetennis8@gmail.com. infinitetennis8@gmail.com. I'm available for lessons in the 510 and the 925. And thanks for everybody who's been listening to past shows and other shows on the network. It shows up. We appreciate the support. Please spread the word and, you know, get involved. Get involved. Be a leader. All right. So thank you, and I'm going to send you off with this. Oh, but am I ready? I'm almost ready. And there we go.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.